This is an appendix to episode 31 of the RACP podcast, Pomegranate Health. That story is titled Nā Kaitiaki Hauoroa, or Guardians of Health. It discusses inequities in health delivery in New Zealand and the future workforce of Māori doctors. You can find it at the website racp.edu.au/pomcast or any podcasting app. The file you're listening to now contains interview excerpts not included in the published story and recordings from a hui in November 2017 near Auckland. You'll hear from Jade Tamatea, Tane Taylor, Riripeti Haretuku, Elena Curtis, Curtis Walker, Peter Jansen, and George Laking. We're very thankful for their contribution, though the views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
With what he said. So we're basing this on Y262. One of the things I took from that is about what is the environment collectively going to look like for Māori and Pākehā in a country that is both Aotearoa and New Zealand empowered in both sides at the same time. The other message I think we've taken from today that was that Leo Buchanan was an exceedingly brave man, and if we're going to follow in his footsteps, we need to be as brave as he was. So I challenge everyone here, particularly those in governance roles, to realise that we have a tsunami of students who have been trained in clinical competency, but also cultural competency. They know about bias, they know about internalised bias, they know about the bias within the system. They then get out into a hospital system where they are trained through a hidden curriculum, which is going to continue to perpetuate that unless we change that now. Maria said it beautifully. This is uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable for Pākehā, but it's a hell of a lot more uncomfortable for Māori. We need to lean into that challenge, meet the tsunami of students, be prepared for them, and train them adequately to be great clinicians when they come out, both clinically and culturally, because there is no reason why you can't be both. Yes, they come out, we have our colleagues that have this biomedical model, but why? Because we've trained them with a biomedical model. We examine them with a biomedical model. We turn up to our clinical exam where I stop hugging my patients and I don't treat them the way I would in my clinical setting because that will get me failed in my clinical exam because that is the way this college has determined what it is to be a physician. So I'm asking the college to turn the lens around and stop this being about what it is about Māori that is different, but what it is about the college themselves and what kind of college we want to be in the future. So I challenge you to be as brave as Leo was and take steps to move towards to keep this going so that we can have this future that we all want. Can I also just ask this one little thing at the end? We like to use the word inequity, and Rhea, I wanted you really to define it for us, because I think we use it in this beautifully, this space where it doesn't have emotion, and we can just talk about it, because it's just another inequity. Let's have another inequity. The definition of inequity is it is a difference which is unfair, unjust, and amoral. It needs to have emotion. It can't just be another disparity. So we have to bring that passion back into inequity. So please define it everywhere you go, Rhea.
Tane Taylor, general practitioner, Māori Health Committee board member for the last 4 or 5 years. Also, I think I'm also the member of the Royal Australian College of Physicians Council member now. The question is, do voluntary professional organisations have any obligations under the Treaty of Waitangi and such instruments? In my view, there's only two positions. You're either on the Crown side or on the Māori side. And the fact that whatever college has taken on some functions on behalf of Crown, such as establishing standards for their members, and they vouch for their performance, and they give the qualifications. Therefore, they are a gatekeeper. So yes, they should come under and must be considered as obligated to acknowledge, honour, and implement the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi.
And how do you see Western medicine, the medicine that we practice within the colleges, and Rongoa Māori coming together under that tribunal?
Well, that's where the challenge is, because the whole construct of colleges and the health systems are, by and large, Anglo-Saxon kind of adopted systems. And therefore, everything is judged under that remit. Everything is developed under that remit. Here's an opportunity now to look at and say, what are we doing? What are we, and why are we doing things? And like all this, especially medical colleges, it's not about their members. It's about how they actually address their patients, their communities. And therefore, they need to start looking at how they can actually do better. So if we continue to do the same, albeit more of the same, are we going to achieve any differences? I don't think so. We need to be looking at how do we actually train not just more doctors and professionals, but how do we train them differently, to deliver differently? And the Māori Health Committee and the Treaty of Waitangi and the place that Māori have in this country can be used as a template, not just for our cause, but also for what happens with the Aboriginal Torres Straits population, but also how do we actually look at Ayurveda? How do we actually look at traditional Chinese medicines? It's the whole concept of, you know, turning the world upside down. Huge challenge, scares the bejesus out of everybody. So I'm not calling for a kind of revolution, but I am calling for let's sitting down and start weaving our strains differently.
It is quite a historic position to be in, to have Indigenous rights discussed at such a high level in such a formal context, and the college is a part of that.
Oh, the college, the work that Leo Buchanan, Mata Leo Buchanan did is, you know, quite obvious. You know, this is the second hui that we've had here, bringing all other colleges, not just the College of Physicians. It's College of Surgeons are here, other institutions are here, College of General Practitioners. But there is a good environment now that people at least can sit down and have conversations, and it's not them and us, it's about we all in together. How can we, you know, move forward for the betterment of our communities?
He mihi kia koutou, e ngā rangatire e noho ana kei konei, e ngā tau iwi koe tai mai, tēnā koutou katoa. A few notes from today's presentation, I think just a couple of points. I would consider myself an insider-outsider. I don't sit inside the medical fraternity. I sit in the education fraternity inside the health sector. And I think it's really healthy that you have a mix of other disciplines, particularly when you're trying to identify what you think the problem or the problems are, because it becomes quite insulated when everybody's kind of singing up the same hymn book. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not. As a mechanism for change, however, this is a very powerful collective. And rightly or wrongly, the world would see you as quite a powerful force, intellectually, culturally. You know, when the doctors say move, you move, right? And so, like it or not, that's the truth of it. Should you use the power that you have to start to make the movements that you've seen and talked about today, and I guess all of us long to? I do note there was something in the PowerPoint that we're a mature sense of national identity. Well, that's loaded, isn't it? Okay, what does that mean? And I also note that during the conversations of the day, people have talked about this idea of bicultural becoming sort of one space. But I think I've been saying this for 20 years, we're not a homogenous group of people. Our exposure to culture in our lives is different across generations. It looks different and we behave differently and we respond differently. So we should probably think about that a little bit. As we were talking again about the treaty, I'm interested because we kind of come back to that base in terms of what did the treaty say. the full, exclusive and undisturbed possession of their lands, estates, forests and fisheries and as other properties they might individually and collectively want, so long as that is their wish and desire to retain in possession. And some of the readings and some of the work in Y262 is where it's almost like, can I please have my reo? Can I please have that bit of culture here? Can I do these things? And at some point, when do we insist this is our right? Or does that get heckles up? Does that mean we need to walk carefully on eggshells about how we get, I guess, the results and outcomes that we want? I don't have too much more to
say. Well, with the MAPAS program and the increased admissions, to put this into context for Australian listeners, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders make up 2.7% of the population, but only 0.9% of... Are you aware of similar programs in Australia and how much more could they model a lot more on what the work you're doing here?
Yeah, no, we'd work extensively with our Australian colleagues around these types of issues, and particularly the work of LIME and Leaders in Indigenous Medical Education. That's a really important organisation focused on these types of issues, and we work together with them. I think it's really important to remember that I think New Zealand, Aotearoa, we've had a 40-plus year history of engaging in these concepts, and obviously we're numerically larger proportion of the population, so that's one issue. But also we have, a strong voice associated with our Indigenous rights in terms of the Treaty of Waitangi, so I think that's a very different context than what's going on in Australia. But if we think around the fact almost, have we had a head start? I think we probably have. We also have a very different context when we've only got 2 medical schools in New Zealand. There's only 2 places that you can go to train to be a doctor in New Zealand, and so we're able to create almost like a cohort effect just in terms of what we do both here in Auckland and Otago. I think for Australia, the slightly different context, you're actually spread thin. You are having to almost, replicate your administration costs of what you're doing as well, because every single university has to have someone in place and you don't really have the workforce to support that. Do you have the political will to support that? So it's quite different. So I think there are things definitely Australia can learn from. Committing to a Bridging Foundation program, committing to a recruitment program, committing to a comprehensive, really comprehensive support program. You have to do all of it. So, and my doctorate was around this really, is around what is the ways in which you can grow an Indigenous health workforce, and I came up with 12 recommendations, and they really reflect what we're doing. So keeping in mind, ideally you should fix the secondary education system, but there is still stuff that you can do as tertiary institutions to address that, and that, I think, that's in your power and in your control. And so it's what commitment, what funding, what positions you put in place. Do you have Indigenous leadership in your institution? Do you have Indigenous workers who can work with the students? Do you fund comprehensive support programs? How do you run an admissions process over 5 days? I'll tell you now, with a huge amount of staff and a big budget. So if you are a dean sitting in a medical school and you want to grow the Indigenous health workforce, well, show us the money, show us the people, and then you will see things happen. So you have to invest in it, but if you're not going to invest in it, then you're not going to get the outcomes. And I think you have to have a key thing is Indigenous leadership and Indigenous medical leadership. So it's not just having a support person to deal with pastoral issues. I mean, we have that, of course. We need that. Our students have huge issues. Our students are representing our statistics. So their parents, their family members are dying much younger. They are dealing with trauma. They are from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. They have more complex lives. So that is a factor. You absolutely need to support people, but then you need Indigenous academics who can sit with fellow physicians around the table and articulate what our students need at a board of examiners, at a board of studies, at a board of admissions. So you need multiple roles, and one support person will not do it.
And you've actually drilled into the household factors of the students across the university, and in your 2016 paper with Edna, you observed that Maori and Pacifica students at Uni of Auckland are 3 times more likely to come from outside the region. So how does this add to the challenges that day to day?
Yeah, I think there's particular challenges for Māori students, I think. They get quite homesick often. Also, if you're trying to engage tribally, which is often outside of Auckland, that's an extra burden. Like, being able to attend funerals or tangi is a very important activity for most Māori students who are connected to their traditional culture. So that can, you know, they may sometimes have to just put that to the side or not attend as many things as they want to, and then that creates a cultural burden on them, which can affect their, you know, spiritual side of their being here and being able to learn and all that. So that does go on, and so being out of the region can be an issue, and we just have looked at that as a factor. I mean, our work with our students is to help them manage that. Look, you're in medicine, you are going to have to engage in a different way. And the way and your time and your availability to give back to your community whilst you're at med school is less. And, you know, there is a bit of give and take that has to happen. So we try and have our students manage that and to maintain some independence.
Was it David Maeda's study that looked at the attitudes towards cultural competency teaching in the medical program? And I can't remember. So a lot of students found it positive and, you know, wanted more of it, but there were comments like, this is a waste of, you know, political correct nonsense, taking time away from clinical teaching.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a reflection of societal values. And you know, teaching Māori health to the total cohort, is a challenge in itself. And we often, as soon as they turn up in the classroom, they've got angry pants on. Why are we learning about Māori health? Why aren't we learning about Asian health? It's like, yeah, and that, it comes back to the rights-based arguments about understanding Māori rights as Indigenous peoples, about that being quite different than just need, and so therefore it's not just about who has the highest health inequities. It's something that you should know because Māori people have rights here in New Zealand under the treaty, under and being Indigenous, under being human. So that's why. And yeah, so we always have to maintain not only a needs-based argument to focus on Māori health, but a rights-based argument, which is reflected in the Treaty of Waitangi. I think you need to start there, but also you need to understand that really the context in which society is set up creates the context in which inequities thrive. So I think we all have a responsibility to look at those patterns of distribution of wealth, distribution of deprivation, all of that feeds into this broader context, as well as whether or not the society is set up in a way that can reflect Indigenous peoples and in terms of identity, in terms of their own sort of health practices, all of that. But yeah, it's everything. Behind all of this is the notion that our education system, our justice system, our employment systems, you know, are all set up with biases against Indigenous peoples. So until we fix that, we won't probably fix the pipeline.
And yeah, so I'd sort of read your research about the attitudes, even from staff. What about the next stage when they become, you know, interns and trainees? Are they more accepted once they've proven themselves?
Particularly with the bullying and harassment that's been going on within the medical context, you know, you would have to surmise that there is unsafe environments out there. And my experience is, of course, that there's very unsafe environments. So we are very worried about the unlearning that goes on and once the students reach clinical context, but we don't know. There hasn't been enough research. And actually, I'm part of a team that are applying for research funding to actually look at this. Particularly...
And one specialty that's mentioned, I've heard mentioned a few times, is palliative care. Apparently there are no Māori palliative care
specialists. Where's the recruitment program?
And I guess palliative care is a good example of an area where you do want that cultural awareness. And
well, part of what we do is not just grow an Indigenous health workforce, because part of the solution too is to grow a health workforce that is culturally safe. So we do a lot of work as well with the non-Indigenous medical students and that is just as important. And
well, given that they're out there,
yeah,
you want them to
do. Yeah, and there's no way, being 3.2% of the medical workforce, that we're going to be able to expect to see an Indigenous doctor wherever we go. So we need those doctors who are not Indigenous to be safe.
We are all part of civil society. We're all part of society. As the Y262 claim makes quite clear, society, this is going to be society. It's currently society. This is where society's heading. And if we're not going to become part of that, what are we going to be part of? And if we're not going to be part of addressing the long-term challenges through such, you know, brilliant discourse and high-level thinking, then what are our organisations going to be? How relevant are we going to be? Yeah, so partnering with organisations, the Medical Council, certainly as the regulator, has partnered with Te Ora, and this is one of now our key strategic directions, to uphold and uptake the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi as espoused, you know, more regularly day-to-day societally, practically by Y262. And through all of that, we certainly hope achieving health equity and fairness across society. And that's not only with iwi Māori, but, you know, with all of the diverse groups within our society. And while we've been in those past modes of colonisation and blame and counter-blame and redress, that has been less possible than I see it being now. And therefore, there are great opportunities to reconcile, get together and become the organisations that we need to be. We are doing that through committees within the RACP, for example. We're doing that clearly with the Māori Health Committee, which is growing stronger and stronger in terms of, you know, our hui here today. I guess so, if we're doing it at that level, where's the next levels that we take our organisations to? And I've often said this in other forums, that, you know, what are our governance structures look like? What do our partnering with other organisations look like? You know, the challenge for the College of Physicians, having a wonderful Māori Health Committee, is to where do we take this next? How do we genuinely change our organisations to look like the society envisaged by Y262, not only within New Zealand, of course, but also within Australia? But the fact that there are so many of us all sitting in this room today I'm certainly feeling in a culturally comfortably safe space, and that's another challenge for our colleges to deliver safety. But I hope, and increasingly, that our tauiwi, our tangata cook, whānau, are also feeling increasingly safe, and that this is your place, as was originally, you know, that is the purpose of the treaty, that we are all here. And I guess, you know, the final sort of part of that is when I heard Humphrey saying that, you know, this was a, and I've asked for his permission to use this, this is a middle-aged white boy saying that part of the challenge is that we need to de-middle-aged white boy our organisations if we're to realise the goals and the dreams outlined this morning. So, ko tēnei te mihi atu ki a koutou katoa, nā tēnei tingo tāunga o te hui. Thank you for the opportunity, and I think this is a great hui, and the Medical Council is not only very keen on this line of work, we're supporting it and we're living it, and I think we've got Paparangi Reid coming tomorrow to also work with us on our own organisation's unconscious biases. So, kia ora tātou.
Let's touch now on the Ungoa Māori. In 2011, the Ministry of Health established a trust to promote Rongoa Māori services, and currently there are 19 publicly funded providers. Can you separate the importance of culture and health? Is Rongoa Māori something that every physician should have an understanding? Or,
well, what are you going to get out of George and I? We're going to get, of course, every health practitioner in New Zealand should understand some of the remedies and ways of working in terms of well-being that Indigenous practitioners have in New Zealand. Of course, we should understand the health practices of anybody coming in the room. What's different here is these are Indigenous health practices, and they support well-being. There might not be randomised controlled clinical trials that prove an effect or not, but that's kind of irrelevant. Because we all know that medicines, for example, and the effect of medicines is culture-bound. I try to explain that to people by saying, remember that last time you had a headache and you took 2 paracetamol? How long did it take before the paracetamol worked? Because probably your answer is going to be a few minutes, long before they were absorbed. And therein is the issue around health practice is just not the biochemical changes or the surgery we inflict on people. It's all of the surrounding stuff, the environment, the way I'm dressed, the way I communicate, the colours, the tastes, the smells, the welcome and the feeling of well-being that I get from interacting with a service that's in tune with my needs. All of those things are important. And that's what Rongo Māori is. It's a particular way of delivering well-being.
There's a great paragraph in the Ko Aotearoa Tēnei. It recommends that the Crown recognise that Rongo Māori has significant potential as a weapon in the fight to improve Māori health, and to see the philosophical importance of holism in Māori health. The place of spirituality and healing may meet with scepticism in some quarters, but it's hardly something foreign to mainstream medicine. We find ecumenical chaplaincy services in most hospitals, and many New Zealanders have embraced a variety of alternative wellness regimes in recent years, such as yoga or Chinese medicine. Why should there be resistance to Rongoa by virtue of its spiritual dimension?
I would add to that that over in Australia, you have a health practitioner registration body that recognises traditional Chinese medicine. I work for the Accident Compensation Corporation, and we fund treatments by acupuncturists and other people who have their own registration bodies. And you'd have to think, we do that for the purpose of rehabilitating people, assisting them to overcome their injuries caused by accident. And that may be a better way to look at what we're doing there rather than saying we're providing a scientific treatment.
So Rongoā, in my understanding, primarily is spirit. Taha wairua, spiritual health. And this was Sir Mason Durie's objection to the notion of health as formulated by the World Health Organization 1947 in terms of physical, mental and social well-being, explicitly leaving out a spiritual dimension for health. And I think that reflects the personal journeys of the people involved in the founding of the World Health Organization, wanting to be avowedly secular. And I'm not sure if I can quote Sir Mason's words precisely, but amputating the spiritual is not up to the task that people need for that full sense of human flourishing that we recognise as health. Now, what is the spiritual? I guess we approach it in different ways, but for me, it relates to ideas including what is the purpose of life. And I don't think psychological or even sociological formulas really actually cover that. And it's certainly what Rongoā practices are trying to draw out. And of course, Western medicine's been having its own conversation with the hospice movement, notably in terms of bringing back that spiritual idea. I have a colleague who refers to the human spirit, which I felt was a helpful way of understanding that dimension.
I mean, I think we all understand that intuitively, but then perhaps our biomedical training sometimes resists that. And when you're talking dollars and cents, the demand is for evidence-based medicine and all of that.
But George, in your field, in cancer care, you deliver very toxic therapies to people, extremely toxic therapies. So the concern is around the safe levels of that toxicity. How much radiation, how much of those chemicals can you pour into somebody to kill the cancer and not kill the patient? I know that sounds, it's a Lego level explanation, but there you
go. It's accurate.
It's pretty accurate. We need to turn our thinking not along those lines. We're talking about medicines that are not of the same ilk, that have a different purpose about well-being. And we don't need to have the safety discussion. It's a very different way of looking at it. But it's not foreign to us, because we understand in our consultations that an appropriate smile and a handshake are really, really important. You can measure the effect of those, but they're not an unsafe thing to do or a safe thing to do. They're just part of good treatment.
These are healing practices that have existed from time immemorial. A smile, a pat on the back, a bowl of chicken soup, for heaven's sake. These are all human ways of picking oneself up and moving forward and recovering. And without these things, people, they stay in bed, they turn their face to the wall, they get worse. I agree with Peter that randomised controlled trials don't really have a place in that sphere. It's been a tool for the formal evaluation of successive generations of new biomedical treatments. The healing practices that we are talking about here are ones that are right at the baseline. These are practices that humans have had from time immemorial.
And in the day-to-day practice of the physicians that might be listening, would a simple thing to introduce might be to ask the whānau or the patient, are there any traditional remedies? Is there that would help you through this? In a practical sense?
I think that's it's always good to ask what else is the patient doing in their life. You haven't heard me use the word complementary, traditional, or any other adjective to describe. So you could introduce the topic gently by using, are you taking any vitamins? I need to know about what vitamins you are, just to make sure they don't interfere with any of the other treatments I'm giving. And after exploring vitamins, you might move on to herbal remedies and teas, or you might move on to massage and physical therapies. All of these things are part of rongoā. And there might be other things that you're unaware of. They may have been given advice to drink 3 litres of Lourdes water every morning.
So it's not so much that the non-Māori physician needs to have a list of these prescriptions at hand. It's more just if they're brought up,
And the better the picture that you can build of the person, the more you can help them. It starts with the undifferentiated patient wearing the blue gown in front of you. That person has been pretty much stripped of a large amount of their humanity, and they're feeling that way as well inside the hospital setting. And so the more you can rebuild and clothe that person with a picture of their life, their connections, their relationships, what they're doing, the more they recover that personal strength that they have. And then when they run into trouble, the more likely I think that we are as doctors to have an insight of what might be not quite right today and how it might be best remedied. Colonisation is ongoing, and there are influences about that reduce people's humanity, turn them into numbers to be pushed around on balance sheets, maximise profit by selling unhealthy food or peddling tobacco or alcohol on every street corner. And if we're not mindful, it can overwhelm us and we lose our own rhythm and our own heartbeat. And I think we're very fortunate as medical people to appear on the scene in people's lives at certain key places and certain key times where they're feeling a bit cast adrift, looking for something to hold on to, and we can play a role in mediating culture in a positive way for people by being aware of these forces that are at play in the wider world.
So bringing it back to the Waitangi Tribunal, the treaty guaranteed protection of really important stuff, Māoriness, our cultural practices, our forests and fisheries and stuff like that. But protecting it just for us? No, protecting it for this place, for all these people. So welcome, everybody. You're now part of the big nation, whether you're Māori or not, and we're protecting all the really important stuff here for us for future. That's the deal. We're not saying rongoā Māori is only for Māori. No, rongoā Māori will be protected because it's an important piece of knowledge that facilitates health.
And Tane gave that sort of anecdote, whether you want to call it Māoriness or Kiwiness. If you're a New Zealander abroad and you see the haka on TV or hear Dame Kiri Te Kanawa singing and you get goosebumps, you're a Kiwi. You've identified with a tradition that might not be yours ethnically, but you've inherited
One of the main points of Ko Aotearoa Tēnei was that reminded us that everyone arrived here originally you had to get here by a boat. The first people to arrive here they carried the cultures of the Pacific here. It's called the culture of Hawaiki, one of the ancient cultures of the Pacific. Over time, those people, through the generations, changed and became Māori. And the contention is that the thing that changed them was this very land itself. The soil we stand on, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the attributes of this land has changed the people. And so one of the observations of Ko Aotearoa Tēnei was that we could see these changes starting to happen with subsequent arrivals. The people of Cook, who may not feel British in virtue of the experience over time of living in this place. So what Ko Aotearoa Tēnei's, I think, then asks us to do is to think about how this process may play out going forward. The first couple of hundred years have been a mixed bag, and there's been a Waitangi tribunal to try and put those things right in keeping with what the land is trying to say to us. And Māori have been listening to that, and the invitation is for all people who settle here to listen to that. And it's my personal belief that that's the origin of the idea of being tangata whenua, people of the land.
That will be a growing up for New Zealand. And you see in other nations, when you go to Hawaii, they call non-Hawaiian people who are embedded in that place kama'aina. And it's a term of affection. You're of this place, but you're not Hawaiian. You're not Indigenous Hawaiian, but you're of this place. We will grow up and have a term. Well, in fact, we've got that term, haven't we, George? It's called Pākehā. Mm-hmm. It was never a term of abuse. It just means you're of us, of this place. You're non-Indigenous, but you're from here.
Yeah.